Good morning, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to the first session entitled Cloud-Based Management Services in Banking and Case Study in IFRS 9. My name is Motlatsi, and I'll be chairing the session today. We have some 60-odd minutes for the presentation and questions, so I'd appreciate if you'd maybe leave your questions to the end. Before I introduce our speaker, maybe just some rules of engagement. As I said, we'll have questions at the later stage, or at least after the presentations. Mobile phones, I think you know what to do with those right now. As usual, we have obviously a number of platforms that you can connect and comment on. Please use for Twitter, use the hashtag #ASA2018, and you can also log on to the handle actuarialSA, I think it is. Yeah? Importantly, please use our app, right? The convention has an app. Please make sure you're registered on there. As you know, I think at the end of each day, there will be prizes for the most active. I think you get points each time you interact on the app. Please, it's in your benefit, I guess, to use that. Also, you'll be able to rate the presenter, obviously. I think he'll also like some of that feedback, so that'll be great for him too. Finally, just the standard stuff. In case of an emergency, please use the main doors. There's also fire exits to my left here. Okay, and about our speaker today, Matt is a director at EY, recently joined EY. He's got, I think he's got some experience in IFRS 9 related stuff. He's worked, he's done some projects both in South Africa and some of the countries on the continent. Model verification, model implementation, verification, audit work. I think he's got some idea what he'll be talking about. Without further ado, Matt, over to you.
Okay. Cool. Thanks, everyone. Yeah, thanks, Motlatsi. I just wanted to start the presentation by talking about why I thought this was a topic worth covering at the convention. Not just because of this artwork provided by ASA, but it does work very well. Thank you, ASA, for that cover. It is because I think cloud-based managed services is a legitimate alternative business model for all banks as well as other financial institutions to be considering. My reasons for why I think this is what I'm going to try and unpack during the course of the presentation. I think one of the really topical things that's come up recently that I think emphasizes this point is the fact that Microsoft Azure were opening data centers in South Africa. In fact, they should be opening this month. They'd announced that they were going to open these data centers back in February. Currently, you may be getting access to Microsoft Azure, but if you are, you'd be using a data center that might be situated in Amsterdam or Dublin, but probably somewhere in Europe. Obviously, from a POPI perspective, protection of personal information, there's going to be challenges around storing certain things overseas. The data centers being based in South Africa will help a lot with that. That's something that, I guess, from a cloud perspective, is quite exciting. Dimension Data, obviously, in the South African market, we're providing similar services, but Microsoft Azure bringing in a lot more competition, something to consider. I think also around the pricing points, and part of the reason why bringing it into South Africa made sense was it was actually only last week, I think on the 16th of October, Microsoft announced that, well, they'd announced previously, but the increase went through last week of a 23.6% increase in their fees. From one day to the next, there's almost a 25% jump in the fees, and largely due to the rand depreciation against the dollar and most of the costing being priced in dollars. It's quite a significant reason, in addition to the security and the legal side, to bring some of those services into South Africa. It is essentially a technology-based presentation, but hopefully quite a practical one. There will obviously be some stuff we're talking about IFRS 9 related, but it's not primarily an IFRS 9 related discussion. Hopefully it is something that you'll find practical, and as we go through it, something that you might find a way to think about how you could implement in your own organizations. Just briefly running through what the presentation covers. We're going to start by looking at some of those those buzzwords. So even the presentation of this talk is just a combination of certain buzzwords, cloud-based managed services, et cetera. So just want to break down some of those concepts and then bring it together with that IFRS 9 case study. And then towards the end, we'll just cover some additional topics we can chat about in terms of IFRS 9 and challenges that have been faced across the continent. So on the topic of buzzwords, where better to start than fintech? So this is something that most of you would you'd be quite familiar with and something that I think might mean different things to different people. So just to contextualize, I put here what is the definition provided by the BCBS, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. As part of some of this mandatory presentation training that you had to go on, I was told that everyone in the audience should be able to read, and I shouldn't read this to you, so I'll leave that to you to look through. But essentially, it's quite a big mouthful, but it's a very, very broad and holistic definition of what fintech might cover. And just as an aside, a portmanteau is the creation, or is a word that you, for taking two separate words like financial technology, putting them together. So if you didn't know that, then at least maybe you'll hopefully remember something and have something interesting to learn from the presentation. So looking to RegTech, so sort of one of the subsets of fintech, and probably one of the areas that have received that kind of tech treatment in more recent times. But like its big brother fintech, it might also mean different things to different people. So this definition, technological innovation that assists organizations with regulatory compliance, I think it's something that hopefully from an actuarial perspective or even just for any other quants working in banking, it's something that you might find to be quite an interesting and quite relevant to you. So looking into RegTech a little bit further, so the name itself might be relatively new, but the combination of using technology to solve regulatory problems is something that has certainly been around for quite a long time, and especially with an increasing focus on data and reporting and increasing levels of regulation in general, it's an area that's becoming more and more relevant for banks to consider. So typically up to now, I'm thinking that in the banking space in particular, you would have had access to a lot of technology, but often through those big tech vendors. So your guys who would sell you very large, complicated software, and if you weren't buying all the different components of that software, you wouldn't necessarily always be getting the benefits of the whole package. So a RegTech solution should be able to try and mitigate some of those challenges. So it's just some of those highlights of what you should get from a RegTech offering would be the agility. This is really the key difference between a RegTech offering and a traditional technology offering. Typically, a standard technology offering would be quite locked down, inflexible, often require programming in proprietary languages. And obviously, with the agility of a RegTech solution, you should be able to bypass some of those challenges in getting solutions developed. In terms of the speed to get it, to produce reports, get things up and running very quickly, I think is something that should be benefit with RegTech. Just thinking in terms of like the cumbersome Excel spreadsheets that often get used in reporting, I think this one is probably even more relevant on the insurance side than on the banking side, but where they are, for example, IFRS 17 solutions being developed, hopefully it could become a catalyst for moving more towards technology-based solutions and away from those cumbersome spreadsheets. In terms of integration, one should expect shorter time frames to get solutions up and running when using RegTech. And the last point there, analytics. A RegTech solution should be able to provide you with additional benefits. So with that same data set that you're using for your regulatory reporting, you should be able to use that information to gain additional knowledge by mining that data. In the middle there, that's interesting statistic. Back in 2014, banks spent in Europe about $55 billion on their IT. Only $9 billion of that was spent on the new systems. So the big bulk of that being spent to bolt on new components to all of their existing systems, or even just to potentially maintain and keep up their existing technology. So kind of demonstrating the need to bring in some more sophisticated or cost-effective opportunities. So where would you typically want to use RegTech? So generally things where there's going to be heavy lifting, a lot of quant work involved. So areas like MR tools, dashboarding tools, etc. But then potentially also just for data warehousing. So in terms of all of these tech solutions, obviously I think something you hear a lot about during this convention would be InsurTech, but there's also PayTech, WealthTech, etc. The last one I want to look at was BigTech. So this is something that as a term may not be as familiar, But it's quite relevant to this presentation because all of these types of firms are very big players in the space. So on the left-hand side there, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, making up the acronym GAFA, and then the ones on the right-hand side, BATs being made up of Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, and all BATs if you include Sina in that. I think, not specifically talking about them, but I just think they, it's interesting to consider. I think I wasn't in the plenary this morning, but I think it's also quite relevant to kind of understand where the Chinese firms are playing in this space. And also they probably have more interesting logos than most of the American companies. It might just be that you're not used to seeing them. So in general, these guys, and I think also Microsoft and IBM included, they're relevant to this discussion because they all provide web-based services that other companies rely on, but also with themselves, with their global presence and their large customer bases, they provide lots of services directly to their own clients. Including financial services, so certainly competitors, to the standard players in the financial services industry. So moving on to the concepts around cloud computing, it's also quite a broad term and covers quite a lot of different services and offerings, which we're going to break down over the next couple pictures. But essentially, though, it's something, it's a situation where you're allowing someone access to a system to run something that doesn't belong to them. So the computer itself, your computer wouldn't be doing most of the work, but the computer on the other side would be doing all of the heavy lifting. So it's something that you would have been quite used to and familiar with, even in a personal context. For people that would prefer Android, everything relating to Gmail, Google Drive, Google Docs, etc., then obviously iCloud's a bit of a giveaway on the Apple side. Some other points and notes. So typically it would be subscription-based, and sometimes you wouldn't necessarily know that you're paying because sometimes you're just paying via adverts for these types of services. Can be used obviously with business or personal use, but cloud computing is in itself a multi-billion dollar industry globally. So it really became a buzzword probably about 10 years ago in about 2008, but the concepts around cloud computing have been around quite a lot longer than that. So if you had to think about that, if you had to guess a decade, what would you say? So it actually was probably from around about the early 1960s. So this picture here at the top is of it's the IBM 1401, which apparently was quite a successful computer with about 12,000 of these things getting sold, each one taking up the entire floor of a building. And back then, the computers were really just a terminal linking to a mainframe, but that mainframe was essentially like the cloud computer that we're talking about today. The picture of the guy at the bottom, John McCarthy, so he was actually the guy, one of the fathers of AI, and the guy that actually coined the phrase artificial intelligence. So maybe a second fun fact there. So, between what he had created and what they started in the 1960s was a time-sharing model where you would be able to use computers more efficiently by using that same network across multiple different users. Typically with the capacity constraints that you had in computers, it just made a lot of sense. But then we went into a phase where most people moved towards their personal computers, and largely because of the cost of those coming down and becoming quite efficient to use. But if you think about it, it's quite interesting that we've kind of gone back full circle. And if you look back over the history of computing in 100 years from now, this time period that most of us grew up with around having a personal computer of your own on your own desk, it could just be like a little blip in the history of computing. So just some, interesting information around cloud computing. NetSuite and Salesforce are probably two of the biggest players in cloud computing, two of the biggest success stories. NetSuite were acquired by Oracle in 2016. They were both around before the tech bubble burst in the early 2000s, came out much stronger on the other side. But something else that I think is very interesting is this picture on the right-hand side here, which is of the IBM quantum computer that you can access from the cloud. IBM started offering the capabilities to access this server or this computer for processing back in about 2016. I think that is what it looks like. Based on my research, that's the best picture I could find. I think it also just illustrates how importantly big tech firms are taking this, this whole kind of venture into cloud computing. So if you were to, consider cloud computing options, what would you be able to do? So there's, I think the two key options here are, public clouds and private clouds, and then hybrids obviously being a combination between the two. So on the, a public cloud, so that's obviously being offered by a third party, a vendor, generally you would expect a better scalability and reliability. But the key difference being the cost efficiency that could be gained from sharing that system across multiple users. On the private side, perhaps a more perceived level of security, but certainly larger, greater flexibility and greater control over how the system was set up and how it could be running. And then a hybrid obviously being a combination of those two models in terms of the benefits that you could gain from it. So thinking now on the third, from a third party perspective, you were getting cloud computer services provided to you. There's various business models of how that can work. So starting at the top of this hierarchy, software as a service. So that's really when you're getting a subscription service just to access software. So typically focused on end users. And then the provider would maintain all of the ownership of the software underlying it and all of the systems. Platform as a service is actually more focused on app developers or software developers. So you would get access to the environment that you could use to develop apps and share apps. It would allow you to create, test, and deploy those any kind of software you wanted to develop. Then looking at infrastructure service, that's another layer down, primarily focused on business. Targeted especially for businesses that are growing fast and rapidly, or where there's key areas or components of the business that aren't key, and that they want to transfer that responsibility to a third party to manage. Another interesting one is function as a service, which would sit between software as a service and platform as a service. It's probably one of the more recent developments. So in that situation, there'd be this level of abstraction between the developers and the virtual machines. The developer would only need to create certain narrow blocks of code that would then sit on top of the other code provided by the service provider. And this type of model is often used when there's online application forms. And the payments for that would generally only get, the payments would only start happening when the services get used. Whereas for the other services in general, it's a perpetual fee model, so you're paying to have a license for a certain period of time. So those are most of the concepts, but this brings us to the next key piece for this, for this topic, which is managed services itself. So again, starting off with the definition, quite a broad definition there, covering everything relating to managed services. But I think in simple terms, it's a glorified version of outsourcing with a more strategic layer attached to the top of it. So why has managed services itself come about? I think you. Certainly, if you read a lot of articles, that are produced by some of the consulting firms, it's something that you'd have seen quite a lot recently. So I think the key reason for the emergence is due to this continual cost of regulation pushing up and up and up, and causing banks to consider these other alternative business models of how they can manage their risks more effectively. So there's some stats there that were, that back that up. This was based off a global risk management survey. Cyber risk and regulatory compliance were kind of expected to grow by most companies between 2017 and 2019 more than any other, and I think that's certainly proven to be the case. And also quite interestingly, globally, banks in 2016 spent about 10% of their annual operating cost just on the regulatory and compliance aspects. So really quite a big significant cost and the motivation for trying to find alternative business models to service these things better. So just taking a look at the evolution of outsourcing, American Express, I think, were one of the first companies to start doing this, and then it was all the way back in 1992, probably before some of the guys were born in this room, I think. So essentially they took a strategic bet to take out part of their business that they thought was going to become commoditized, so that transaction processing unit of their business, and ship that out into an outsource function so that they could take a strategic focus on growing and developing the card issuing business that they had. So what I wanted to go into next is, if you were to consider managed services within your organization, what are the kind of considerations that you need to look at? So for this, we're going to look, comparing where would you want to use a managed service versus where would you use traditional outsourcing, where would you want to continue with in-house execution, and considering this in terms of three different functions within a bank. So that could be designing and validating internal controls, managing the back office IT area of the organization, or credit underwriting and monitoring. And in this context, on the credit underwriting side, we're talking more about, traditional lending decision-making in the business context, where you'd have guys sitting there looking at financial statements, looking at calculating financial ratios, and using that as the basis for making lending decisions. Okay, so if we start with that credit underwriting and monitoring, this is the typical type of thing that would fit best into an in-house execution mode. So the types of things that we're looking about coming up with this decision is, to what degree does that failure of that component increase enterprise risk? What's the kind of focus there around competitive differentiation of this part of the service? Are there specialist technical expertise involved? And is there a high velocity of change around those technical skills? So do you need to be staying on top of changes in regulation, new methodologies coming out, all of these sorts of things that you need to be thinking about? So we just break this one down, looking through credit underwriting and monitoring. From an enterprise risk perspective, certainly can be quite high. So if you're doing this wrong, you're either going to be lending to customers who are not going to be able to pay you back, or you're potentially cutting out a lot of customers that could be profitable. So that's quite a key component. Also high competitive differentiation. So if you can lend better than your clients or than your competitors, if you can find the best clients in the market, you're going to be making more money than your competitors, because you're either making sure that you're picking up the best clients in the market, offering the most appropriate rates given their levels of risk. So then if we look at the specialist technical expertise, generally quite low. So again, thinking from a business perspective, where the methodologies around credit lending have been very consistent over time, quite a stable environment in terms of the skills and the experience required, and therefore also quite a low velocity of change in those skills. So that sort of makeup, in this framework, is the type of areas that you'd want to focus on using in-house execution. So then I guess brings us to the next one. So what about traditional outsourcing? So the key types, I think this that American Express example is quite similar to this. So managing that IT office infrastructure is something that a lot of organizations have been outsourcing for quite a period of time, and something that works quite well in this context. So certainly there can be high enterprise risk if your IT functions fail, but if you break down all of the IT within an organization, there's some components that are very key, but there's some components that could even go down for a day and it wouldn't cause a significant issue for the organization. So that, hence that one being in the middle, not as high as what we were previously looking at from a risk perspective. So, definitely not an area where there's competitive differentiation. So if you just think from how you would choose the bank that you want to bank with, or in a company that you want to take out insurance policy with, you don't really have any consideration for the IT infrastructure that's at the back of their services. So some level of specialist technical expertise and a reasonable change in terms of the skills required, but quite stable and not an area where there's a lot of changes or a lot of rapid changes around the technology and the experience required. So that brings us to the third one. So what actually then works in a managed services context? So out of those three options that we're looking at, that would be the designing and validating internal controls. So we break this one down. If you think about the risk to an organization, it can be quite high. So thinking about if your financial statements aren't produced on time, or if your regulatory returns don't get to the regulator on time, you're going to find yourself in a situation where you could be getting quite significant fines. So the penalty of the fine itself is an issue, but then also the reputational risk associated with that could be quite significant. But not an area where there's any competitive differentiation. So it's not something that, again, clients would be concerned about when they're choosing who to bank with or what type of company to take out insurance product with. In terms of the expertise, if you're thinking about building regulatory models for capital, for provisioning, et cetera, quite a lot of specialist expertise required, but also quite a lot of change if you're thinking about new technologies that are coming out, new methodologies that are being developed, trying to stay up to date with academic literature on the best methodologies, also changes coming out from regulators, additional recommendations, etc. So quite a lot of challenge around those areas, but this would be the type of opportunities where managed services could play a role. So just summarizing what would then make up the logical places to focus on applying managed services, it would be where there's that relationship and a need for urgent specialized skills that could be evolving quickly, where competitive differentiation is definitely very low, and just getting back to that general definition, it's an area where you'd want to have a focused strategic relationship that would allow the organization to focus on their top strategic priorities. Okay, so if we take those concepts that we're talking about up until now, we take the RegTech and we kind of blend it with cloud computing and the managed services, what type of issues could you solve? So there probably are quite a few things you could think about, but IFRS 9 in a banking context is certainly one of those areas. So there's four dimensions. If we just think about what a managed service needed to cover, requiring specialist skills, a high risk area to the organization, high velocity of change. I think that's something to be determined still, but I think generally in these areas, and certainly over the next few years, there could be quite a lot of velocity of change in terms of better methodologies coming through, you know, things especially like on the macroeconomic forecasting, et cetera. But definitely not an area where there's any competitive differentiation for organizations. Also, if you place, you know, accounting compliance under that general reg umbrella and thinking from a reg tech perspective, the definition, just going back to that, what you had earlier, technological innovation that assists organizations with regulatory compliance and with managing the risk more effectively. So we can definitely tick that box as well, something that, you know, a managed service could assist with. Okay, so looking at this case study of how it could apply in, you know, in the world of IFRS 9, starting on the left-hand side here, bank process relating to the data generation, and then on the right-hand side, also going back into the second component of the bank's process, and in the middle is a piece that's provided as a managed service. You can see I didn't color that block in black, so it's not a black box. That's really not the point of the exercise here, but we'll break down some of those components that sit within it. So the bank process initially would be generating data out of their core banking systems, sometimes even putting data out of spreadsheets, and sometimes, you know, in some extreme cases, taking stuff out of physical files even. Moving to, you know, then taking that, all of those data from those various sources, reconciling them, standardizing them, and masking them, uploading them into a cloud storage facility, and then from that, you know, we start the managed service process, which is creating some data quality assessments, and based on that, giving data quality reports back to the bank, and the bank with that feedback could potentially be updating things, correcting issues, so that by the time it gets your results, everything is making sense. So once the data is okay, move into that ECL calculation process. For people not working in banking, that's the expected credit loss calculation engine. So it's really the, you know, the nuts and bolts of how we calculate the provision. Following that is a stage allocation. So again, kind of talking to some of the specific requirements around IFRS 9, allocating accounts either to stage one, stage two, or stage three, depending on how they're performing and if they're up to date with their, you know, with their payment terms. Following that, we get to the base IFRS 9 results. And so that's all produced within the managed service component. The way this structure is set out, the forward-looking information and other portfolio adjustments potentially could be sitting outside of the base calculation models. So with that process, then with those adjustments from management and that oversight from management, getting to our final IFRS 9 results. And then with that system, with all of that happening within a system, the managed service provider could go back to producing MI reports for management, creating the IFRS 7 disclosures, creating other risk finance dashboards, and also potentially calculating the journal entries that would need to get posted, you know, for the accounting, from the accounting point of view. So that's in an IFRS 9 context how, you know, how a managed service could work. On the forward-looking information piece, you know, there's still an option that could sit within a managed service or even be provided as a separate service in itself. But I guess that just, I think, probably gives you a kind of a general sense of how the process could work. Similarly, within an IFRS 17 context, I think for the insurers in the room, you could think about how this type of process could work in that context as well. So then just thinking about some of the benefits that could be gained of using this sort of approach, and really, this is actually now taking a combination of the benefits of using cloud, using a managed service provider with the right expertise. You could create some more scalable, agile solutions, so making it easier to grow your business as you kind of grow your books, as you add portfolios. Takes away some of the pain points around managing large, complex systems. It gives you that ability to add or remove features, and also on the cloud, you know, from the cloud perspective, almost getting to a point where you have an infinite amount of storage that you could use. From a security perspective, I think it's important to appreciate that the providers of these sorts of services have a very big vested interest in making sure that their security systems are always up to date. So it's something that's, you know, that's really core to what they offer. And so in terms of what they offer, they really are, you know, at the front of the pack. So some of the things that they would consider there is, you know, how the data centers are set up in terms of storing data across multiple servers, always encrypting data whilst at rest and whilst in transition. So generally, like, managing all of that, you know, in the best way possible. You'd also get more flexibility and customized control over your data. The convenience of access, meaning that, you know, if that system's sitting in a cloud environment, you can access it from anywhere in the world. I guess there's pros and cons to that, but certainly giving you the flexibility if you needed it. And you'd always, in theory, have a solution that's up to date, because that, you know, the responsibility for ensuring the compliance with regulation and best practice is now, you know, something that is in the hands of that, of the service provider. I think also from a cost-saving point of view, the pay-as-you-use principle is very important. So that can work from a storage point of view and also from a processing point of view. So in terms of the storage itself, you know, you can scale up and add on data or add on storage space as you require it, rather than, say, you know, buying things up front and having it, you know, sit unused for, you know, for potentially months or years. And then from a processing perspective, you also have the flexibility to add processing power for certain periods of time. So during your month-end process, if you needed things to be running, or if you're running a lot more processes, you need things to be run faster, you could scale up your processing power for just that last week around your reporting period, and then for the rest of the month, scale that back. So you're not even paying for all of the processing power that you need, you know, on a continuous basis. So that sort of paints quite a rosy picture of how managed services could work and, you know, the value they could add. But there are also obviously some practical considerations that you'd need to think about if you wanted to really get into this. So I think the one concept there is that the provider should have skin in the game. So thinking about having indemnification, having clear SLAs in place. So understanding, if you think about that IFRS 9 process, how you go from the data upload into the cloud and then the handoffs back to management, being very clear about the responsibilities and where they lie. And also even relating to the, you know, the time frame that you have for month-end reporting to ensure that the SLA covers the time period that each of the components need to be provided by. In terms of stakeholder concerns, I think it is possible through that SLA process, you know, to create specific measurable goals that can then give all of the different stakeholders in the process the comfort that they require. One of the complexities here is that you are working with risk teams and finance teams and business teams, so you need to be able to tick the box for all of them across this whole process to make sure that everybody's happy. In terms of what you want to, you know, to look for in a managed service provider, some things could be, you know, the consideration around their own track record, their ability to, you know, meet their own compliance requirements, their abilities to audit, to design the processes and to execute on what they, you know, what they're committing to. The quality of their staff, and also thinking about that, the possibility of their own staff turnover, contingency plans that they might have in place for if some of their key staff members leave. In terms of the provider's reputation, thinking about how they've interacted with other industry participants, their relationship with the regulators, etc. Also, obviously, their relationship with the vendors that they would be relying on. Do you need them to have a global footprint? So depending on where you as an organization are operating, it might be important that you have a provider that understands, you know, some of the nuances in some of the areas that you operate in, given some of the, you know, the regulatory variations across the continent that we live on. In terms of institutional strength, thinking about their financial soundness is quite important, understanding that, you know, will they be a going concern a couple of years from now when you're still relying on them and their services. And that's as part of the process of how you'd set up these agreements. You also then need to think about what happens if they go out of business. What type of dependency do you have on them? Even thinking down to the level of the IP of the system that they've built, is that something that can revert back to you, or is that something that's always going to sit on their side? And if you don't have those sort of things agreed up front, you get to a point down the line where you could really be, you know, in a tight position and not know what to do. So I think ultimately the key practical consideration, it comes down to the cost versus benefit. So can you set up an arrangement with a managed services provider that will provide you with all of the benefits that we spoke about on the previous slide, but also do it in a way that's going to be cost effective to you? So next, I just want to touch on some of the regulatory concerns around this. So I think it is, you know, even if you think that up to this point this all sounds, you know, quite good, it's something that's worth considering. You know, it's actually interesting to note that there has been some guidance and some comments from the Reserve Bank around this. So the SOBS Prudential Authority released a discussion paper last year in 2017, which was then finalized as Directive 7 of 2018, and this was only released last month, in fact, along with a guidance note. So it's relatively still hot off the press, but what these papers did was clarify some of the concerns and some of the things that, you know, they thought one needed to consider before using cloud computing, and also for any considerations around offshoring of data. So quite a useful paper to look at if you were going down, you know, if you wanted to go down that road. Also, interestingly enough, they released a paper on specifically on the topic of outsourcing back in 2014. So they have been quite proactive around thinking about these things. So overall, they do recognise the benefits of outsourcing and the benefits that cloud computing can bring. But what are these, all of these little blocks on the screen here, I think, are just of the areas that their papers have kind of covered in terms of things that they, you know, that they think banks or other financial institutions would need to consider and be careful with. I'm not going to go through all of them. I think a couple that are quite interesting to point out is supervisor access and audits. So, you know, when you're setting up these sorts of processes and systems, it's important to ensure that the auditors can get access to all of the data they need and when they need it, as well as the supervisors. So at no point, you know, through the use of a cloud computing structure or through the use of a managed service provider, can you get to a point where you can inhibit the supervisors' access to the data and the reports that they require. So I think overall quite positive in terms of what their views are and what they're proposing. So I guess to move a little bit, I guess, onto a tangent here, so thinking about IFRS 9 in Africa, I think where it is relevant to some of the previous information is that if we look through some of these challenges, what we're talking about before is actually certainly something that can help overcome some of the challenges that countries have seen around the continent. So some of those key challenges, the interpretation of accounting standards, I think this was more of a global challenge. It wasn't necessarily an Africa-specific challenge, but something that all the firms were struggling with even up to some point during this year of 2018, despite the implementation of the date being 1 January 2018. The other three, I think, are, general to some extent, but also the areas that are more important to banks across Africa: data integrity, the systems, and the skills question. So in terms of the data and the systems, I think there's also a disparity between the organizations in Africa that are, related to your big four banks in South Africa. So the big four banks in South Africa with operations in these other countries, they have that big brother mentality that they'll get looked after. Also, when there's other international banks that have operations across the continent, Standard Chartered as an example, they have a lot of support coming from that global party. Where there's bigger challenges are for the organizations that are only working in countries, across the continent outside of South Africa. They also don't have that opportunity to kind of sweep things under the carpet or downplay some challenges due to the materiality. So from a group perspective, if your South African operations are 90% and your African operations are only 10%, just on a materiality basis, you can get away with doing simpler things across the rest of your operations. If you only operate in some of these other countries, opportunity doesn't exist, and you need to ensure that you're fully compliant in all of those countries themselves. So the countries that I've highlighted on the right there on the map, so these are the countries that, to the best of my researching capabilities and some of the network that I've tried to reach out to, were able to clarify for me and were actually able to provide me with the papers or the guidance papers provided by these central banks. So these are, it may not be a fully comprehensive list, but if there are others out there, I think I would be quite interested to know. Nigeria is in the West Africa there. They'd released guidance around the implementation of IFRS 9 quite far back, in fact, before the South African Reserve Bank did. And they were, that was really just talking about some of the modeling components and how you should help to build the models. So down the right-hand side there, East Africa, Kenya, the little ones, Rwanda, if you weren't sure, and Tanzania. So those countries all released guidance, and their guidance covered some aspects around the methodologies, but also around the transitional arrangements. So the transitional arrangements is how banks need to take the difference between IAS 39 to IFRS 9 and the impact that could have on the capital of the bank, and how they could adjust for that over a certain period of time. So Kenya took the maximum allowable period, so they were allowed to take that transitional adjustment over 5 years. Rwanda, 4 years. Tanzania was similar to South Africa. They were allowed to make an adjustment over 3 years. So I think there is a caveat in that a lot of these countries don't necessarily need transitional arrangements because the regulatory reserves that they need to hold, so essentially like the provision that the central bank pushes down on them, would in some situations be significantly high and higher than what they thought the IFRS 9 provision was going to be. So if that was the case, then they wouldn't have had to have a challenge around the transition. But whether that was really going to be the case in, you know, in all countries, I think was quite optimistic. So, it's not clear that there wouldn't be a transitional challenge for some of these countries, despite actually having that statutory provision or that, you know, that regulatory provision that they needed to hold. So I think we can come back to this one if there's any questions specifically around the rest of Africa, and I think it's something I'll maybe also put out to the floor if there's any, you know, anyone else that has other comments around other countries in Africa and their understanding. I think certainly in some countries I'm aware of there being like bilateral discussions between the banks and the central banks, but these are the countries that I'm referring to where there's actually been publicly, you know, available information. So then just to summarize everything, I think three questions that I'd leave you with to think about would be, are you getting the most out of your data currently? Do you understand the regulatory technology existing within your organization? And are you leveraging all of that existing technology to the full extent of its capabilities? And the flip side of that, do you think you're paying for things that you don't actually need? And if you answer yes to any of these questions, then I would encourage you to think about trying to use cloud-based services or managed services or a combination of the both. Thank you. If you have been, thank you for listening.
Great, thank you, Matt. We have some 10 minutes for questions. I think there's a mic going around. Maybe I can start off. I mean, in essence, the question you're trying to answer is really a cost question, right? It's about where do you want to spend, where's your capital expenditure? It's about where is it most efficient, where do you want to, you know, to be most efficient and get the most bang for buck, in essence, right?
Yes, I think the cost question is definitely a big one. And I think when you're looking at the alternatives here, so one of the key alternatives is using these large vendor solutions. And the cost of those can be quite significant. So it's the question of the managed service plus the, I guess, potentially lower technology cost compared to the large technology cost of large vendors. I think that's one of the key components that you need to think about in that cost-benefit analysis.
And just two other questions, just in your experience on the rest of the continent. First is that, I mean, I'd be interested to know what regulators make of this, right? So in other words, are they happy that the banks would be using effectively managed services stroke outsourced solutions? And also then the question about how do you upscale local staff if all you're doing then, you know, they're just doing effectively the credit work to get the business on the books and then everything else gets done elsewhere.
So I think, so the BCBS had released papers and then the South African Reserve Bank's, you know, papers and guidance is often based on those, which is the general process with most of the regulation and the guidance. And then what I guess what you see very commonly is that across the rest of the continent, there's a similar sort of uptake. A lot of guidance being taken across the continent from the South African Reserve Bank. So to the extent that the view of the Reserve Bank is positive around these things, it's most likely that most of these other most of the other regulators across Africa will kind of have a similar view. And then in terms of, I think the point you're alluding to in terms of the skills and and the development, I think that's definitely a challenge already. So to the extent that there isn't the skills in country to be able to produce, the models and to run the models, to the extent that they're required, there's definitely a gap for essentially outsourcing that to someone who's got the right skills and technology to do it. But I think one of the important aspects of that is that as management of a bank, the CFO, CRO, and the board are still taking full responsibility for the results. So whilst there's a component there that they're outsourcing to get some of the complex work done, responsibility doesn't change hands. So they would always still remain responsible for the results that are being produced. So I think that, that's a key point around around the skills and the knowledge. But In terms of like the modeling approaches themselves, I think over time it's something that, you know, as people develop, they could bring that more in-house.
There's a question there.
Thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to ask, just similar to the point that you mentioned now, what's the impact of the outsourcing from the point of view that the skills are now sitting outside the organization, to the extent that the management who take responsibility for those results actually understand the risks and the going-ons in the business?
Sorry, can I also add on, especially on that question, just especially around IFRS 9? The fact that, I guess, board of directors have to take responsibility for all of this, and yet, you know, in essence, I mean, I don't know where, obviously you'll write some terms of agreement about, terms of engagement about what gets outsourced and what, but ultimately they're taking responsibility for that.
Yes, that's correct. So they would have to take responsibility, and I think the way that they get comfort would be around the amount of disclosures and those report, and the management information that gets produced. So you know, it's not just a case of getting a final number and having to sign off on the final number. There should be enough supporting information along the way and enough discussion with the provider to get them to the point of, you know, being comfortable enough to sign it off. It is a little bit similar to the situation within a bank where, you know, there's a modeling team could be, you know, quite far removed from a CFO. But there's a lot of discussion and, you know, validation and processes in place that get them to the point of being comfortable.
So can I ask just a follow-up question on that, which I thought of now, has there been any improvement that you've seen in cases like this with the integrity of the process in that it's now outside the organization?
So, yes, I think it is still relatively new. But, personally, I have seen it, and I think there might be other people in the room that have also had similar experiences. But I think there are some use cases around where this has been able to work quite well. And even again, coming back to like the more kind of traditional versions of outsourcing, you know, especially around IT functions, that there's a lot of complexity around those relationships already, and, you know, certainly they've been in place, you know, in some cases, you know, over the 20 years.
There's a question here. There's a question here at the front, but just hold on, the mic is on its way. While the mic is making its way there, maybe I can just come back to the IFRS question. So, I mean, there's obviously, a lot of people are still finding out. I mean, it's been a hectic 10 months, just in terms of very steep learning curves and discoveries and things like that. And particularly in the question of modeling, because nothing's been standardized yet. Everybody's effectively still working around and trying to find, I guess, what works in a safe middle ground to settle on. And this is where I think the question about responsibility for CFOs and things like that, about what they're actually signing off on, especially, you know, from that perspective that everybody's still trying to find their way around issues, complexities of, you know, the credit modeling, forward-looking data, and, you know, customizing it and making it work for the company. And that's what I'm just trying to get a good sense of the way things are going. In other words, are the consultants or the outsourced providers providing that sort of standardization in a way? Or how is that working out?
So I think it varies a lot. So I think, yeah, and I think South Africa is far ahead of, you know, the rest of the continent on most of these things. So the South African Reserve Bank required all of the banks in South Africa 5 months after the implementation dates to have reports that, what we essentially send reports to the South African Reserve Bank, you know, explaining how they've done a lot of these things. So that has been quite well governed. Definitely in the rest of Africa, I think there's not the same level of appreciation of some of the complexities and, you know, simplified approaches. And coming back to the point around, you know, so where there's a South African bank that has operations across the continent, most of the models would have been developed in South Africa. So that, you know, in those situations, the level would be, you know, relatively good. But for organizations that don't have that support, would have generally been relying a lot more on consultants and external parties to, you know, develop the models and get them up to speed. One of the challenges there would have been that if you didn't have the sufficient data in place early enough, you know, there's been a lot of people who wouldn't have made the, you know, they wouldn't have made the right sort of the timeline. So if you were with the 1 Jan, you know, implementation date and quarterly reporting it, you would have actually needed to produce IFRS 9, you know, numbers for the first quarter at the end of March this year. So, you know, definitely a lot of banks weren't in the position to be able to do that. So it's still challenged.
Thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks. You mentioned a very interesting fact that prices for the Microsoft cloud services went up by about 23-24%. That's a huge jump. One of the, I think the advantages of using cloud services is the cost, right? So I'm just wondering where currently that level is, even after the 23%, with how that compares to maintaining the stuff in-house. And secondly, I've got a friend who works in the banking area who was mentioning that banks are moving more towards cloud-based data services. I was just wondering what your view on that is in the future. What's most likely to happen?
So I think my view would be that I think more banks and other financial institutions would be moving more towards that model. The biggest issue with the cost of, you know, that Azure had was because of the, you know, the prices coming through in US dollars and having to be converted to rands. So you're subject to that currency fluctuation. So which is why the data centers being developed in South Africa will help a lot on the costing side from that point of view. So there will obviously be some costs that wouldn't be, you know, rand denominated, but I think the largest portion of the cost would be. So that would allow them to kind of manage the costs better. Dimension Data, as a South African provider, I think would be subject to that, you know, the US dollar fluctuation as much as Microsoft would be. But I think in future also Amazon would be, you know, I think also looking to come into South Africa. So I think there will become more competition as well. And with the more competition, then you'd also expect that, you know, the prices would become more competitive.
Hi. I just wanted to ask. So you spoke. Where would so when you speak about this managed service offering, is EY providing the managed service, and would it be on audit clients? And could you also do a similar thing for non-audit clients in terms of modeling their exposures, that sort of thing?
Thanks, Daniel. So I think there's good points around audit versus non-audit. So an audit company wouldn't definitely not be able to provide these sorts of services to one of their audit clients. So it's because of the independence rules. A company that does audit work could potentially be providing these sorts of services to non-audit clients. But then at the same time, a company that isn't an audit company could be providing these sorts of services, you know, to anyone in the market. I think I guess one of the dichotomies there is the experience and the global support and the infrastructure behind some of the big companies versus, you know, smaller, essentially fintech startups that could offer a similar service.
If I can slip one in before the floor. Could you also give us an indication of what the take-up is in South Africa versus other countries of, you know, managed services? So in other words, are providers finding more traction outside of South Africa, or is there actual good take-up locally here in the local banks?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, because you know, when you're referring to the whole globe, it's hard to get a good sense around these things. But so in my experience, I have seen this being implemented in the UK and across parts of Europe, as well as I would guess, you know, a little bit of South Africa, but more the rest of it, so in the rest of Africa. So I think a general take up in all areas, but something that's still in its infancy.
Thank you. Thanks for your presentation, Matthew. So my question is around what in this case, focusing on the outsourcing services or the managed services, that when I look at the work that goes into the blending of the approach or integration. So there's a lot of work around there. So as much as you're moving a lot of functions and depending on the expertise of an outsourced service provider, you still do some work for the integration purposes. So my question is around changing and switching outsourced service providers. What is the ease of doing that, considering the work that goes into integration, and what risks exist in terms of continuity, where you had been, let's say, using a specific service provider for a long time, and you have established dependencies around that? And so also, what can companies do to mitigate such exposure to that risk?
Yes, so yeah, I think definitely the challenges. In terms of the implementation, it's a big exercise in itself. So there would be, I think, a specific project that you need to set up, and I think that comes back to that. So the piloting and running some parallel, portfolio. So you wouldn't just, between 1 month and the next, change over completely. So you'd probably run some of these services in parallel and ensure that you're getting consistent results, that the processes are working. Start on smaller portfolios before kind of ramping up to more material portfolios before, potentially shifting everything across. So there's, I think, a structured way that you could do that, but still quite a significant exercise for sure. What is the second part of your question?
So just the issue of now there may be for different reasons a need to switch and change an outsourced service provider. So how do you manage towards or against that risk when you have or may have to do that?
Yes, okay, sure, thank you. So, very it could be very complicated to do this. So a challenge that that you need to, think about upfront and through the contracting process, through the legal agreement, have clear breakaway clauses in place. So you need to be thinking about right upfront, if you were to depart from using this provider for any reason, like how does it actually work in terms of IP? So do you get to use that same model? Can that same model be handed over to another party to run? Can we bring it back in house? So there are quite a few options there, but not necessarily like one right answer. So depending on the organization, depending on the agreement that you have in place, there could be alternatives, but definitely something that you should have a plan for before you actually start.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I think this is quite an interesting topic. I mean, there are obviously quite a lot of issues that we could go into, and especially about which portions. I mean, do you do a full service, full managed service, or do you do portions of this? And, what kind of criterion are you using to do that? I think that it's quite an interesting space to watch and model, and I guess in a way, and I think you did mention that a lot of it, I guess, is going to be quite commoditized as things settle, as particularly in the IFRS 9 space. So I think we'll certainly see a lot more of this development within MS managed service space. Okay, thank you everybody, and thank you to our presenter, Matthew Walker.